Good morning and Happy New Year and all that sort of stuff. As Sarah says, today we're going to talk about the history of Haiti. It seems appropriate we should start with a prayer. So if you'll join me in prayer. Dear Lord, we thank you for this opportunity to be together and start the new year with learning about our brothers and sisters in Haiti. We ask that you give us open minds and clear heads as we enter into this discussion, which we do in honor of you. We ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen. the Kyles have produced a map, or at least copied a map, which you all have, and which is up on the screen if you don't want to look at the look at the map. I'm a big believer in the fact that things make more, you know, history of countries makes more sense if you can actually look at the country. This is, I think you'll find this somewhat interesting and useful, and I'll point out some things about that as we go along. The problem with this, or not problem, what with doing the history of Haiti is there's way more than 2 hours worth of material, which from my viewpoint is both good in that it means I'm not going to run out of stuff at the, you know, 1.5 hour mark, but it also means I'm stuck with the problem of Bob Seger's song, What to Leave In and What to Leave Out. So in order to try and fit the material into the time frame, but also to help it make more sense in terms of our understanding Haiti, rather than preparing you for a history test on all of the ins and outs of Haitian history, which is a bit tricky to keep track of. It's not quite as bad as a Russian novel, but almost. So I'm going to summarize vast chunks of things, of parts of the history, and just describe to you basically what happened without going into all of the description of the people and who did what to whom and how it happened. This does make it easier to understand, I think, but it also has the effect of missing out on some really interesting characters, some of whom were really good characters and some of whom met really well and some of whom are despicable. But we're going to lump them all together at various places and skip over the ins and outs of various presidents of Haiti coming and going. So I'm just warning you, that's sort of the way we're going to going to go at this. The history of Haiti covers a little over 300 years. It has good guys and bad guys, like everything. Among the bad guys are the political elites, the military, the French, the English, and, of course, the Americans. It's a rather long and complicated story, as you'll see. And to understand it, as with understanding almost anything about history, it requires us to put aside what we think we know about Haiti and to put aside what we know and think as 21st century Americans. You can't look at the history of Haiti over 300 years as if you were a 21st century American. You have to put yourself, as the American Native Americans would say, you can't understand a man unless you've walked in his moccasins for 100 miles. You can't understand the Haitians unless you can put yourself into, well, how would I feel, in this culture, in this situation, which is entirely different than what I grew up in and know anything about. So you have to sort of leave the 21st century behind you and move yourself into a very different culture if you're going to have any hope of understanding what's going on with these people. because these people live in a very different culture, and over a period of hundreds of years, obviously lots of things change. So you have to sort of go with them and not try to impose our views about how this is going to work. Columbus arrived in the New World in 1492, for better or for worse, and the first place he stopped at was an island which he named Hispaniola. This is the western half of Hispaniola, okay? And he left a small colony there, which got wiped out by the natives almost immediately. But after a while, the Spanish came back and built a colony, which they called Santo Domingo, after Saint Dominican, the founder of the Dominican order. And some centuries later, that area, namely the eastern area of the island, becomes the Dominican Republic. The French arrive in the western half of the country in the later 17th century, and they translate the Spanish name Santo Domingo into Saint Domingue. Okay, they francophize the name, obviously. So there's in Haitian history lots of references to Saint Domingue, which just means Haiti from our perspective. The native populations of the island, of course, had several names for the island, including you can pronounce it as you want. But that means land of mountains. And obviously it's that word which, with slight variation, becomes Haiti when at some point after independence the guys who are carrying out the revolt are looking back for something to name the country that's a break from the French, since they're breaking from the French. And so they come up with Haiti. So it's just a derivative of a native word. And it also, it carries with it the sense of fighting, the natives fighting against the Spanish as invaders into their country, into their island. So if you've just fought off the French, that makes a lot of sense. It comes together in a nice metaphor. There are a lot of metaphors in Haitian history and in songs, as you might guess, where they tie things together in lots of ways. It's a way more sophisticated culture probably than we think of it as being. So by the middle of the 16th century, that's the 1500s, the native population of perhaps 500,000 to 750,000 had almost completely been eliminated by war, forced labor, and disease. The white guys brought disease with them, which basically the Native Americans all over North America couldn't handle. And we killed a lot of them just plain by bringing smallpox and a few other things with us when we came from Europe. The French settlers were originally squatters, and they had originally been pirates up here on the island of Tortugue. Because the Spanish never figured out what to do with their half of the island. And so they used it as a stopping off point and for ships coming out of Latin America loaded with gold and silver heading back to Spain. So it was prime pirate area, and the Isle of Tortugue was a great place among other ports on the western side, to hang out and wait till you could refurbish your ship and wait for the next treasure ship to come by that you could jump on. So they were originally squatters, but in 1697, Spain ceded them, the western half of the island. Now, Haiti is maybe a third of the island, actually. The Dominican Republic is a little larger if you look at the look at the totality of the landmass. And Haiti, of course, has all this cutout of water here, which the Dominican Republic side doesn't have. The effect of this, however, is that Haiti has a whole bunch of really great ports. Maybe not ocean liner ports or oil tanker ports, but great ports, especially in days of sailing ships or early steamships. Haiti and a lot of the other Caribbean islands turn out to be perfect for growing sugarcane. Haiti has the region's highest mountains. The water comes down from the mountains and waters a series of large flat plains, which are a really good place to grow sugar. They have, as I mentioned, lots of protected bays, which are ideal for anchoring ships. The island is also right at the end of a very strong current which comes across the Atlantic. So it's very easy to get to Haiti from Europe. On the other hand, there's also some strong currents that come across directly from Africa, which makes it very easy to bring slaves from Africa directly to Haiti. Now, French Saint-Domingue became the most profitable colony in the world. By the late 18th century, it was the world's largest producer of sugar, exporting more than the colonies of Jamaica, Cuba, and Brazil combined. And Jamaica was the foremost sugar-producing British colony. In 1776, the value of the sugar coming out of Jamaica alone exceeded the value of all the goods coming out of the 13 colonies that were in the process of revolting. Jamaica was extremely valuable. Well, Haiti swamps it in terms of sugar production. The island also grew one half of the world's coffee. So this was an extremely valuable colony for the French. They were making tons of money off of this. It covered only about 10,600 square miles, about the size of Massachusetts. So there's a lot of money being made per square mile. So the official estimate of the population in 1789, which happens to be the date of the start of the French Revolution, was 55,000 free people and 450,000 slaves. Now, the slaves are probably over half a million. Slaves were taxed, so there was every reason not to quite report every slave to the government if you possibly could, because it kept your taxes down. So the estimates are that it's probably a lot closer to half a million. In the parish, and as happened in slave situations, the slaves vastly outnumber the free white guys, and so in the parish in which the 1791 revolt started, there were 3,500 slaves and 130 white people. Do you want? Oh, I'm going to get to that. I'm working my. The problem with Haitian history is it's a semi-seamless web, and wherever you start, you're missing things, but I can't do a matrix. I have to do it linearly. So I'll get to the slave problem in a minute. The free population itself was deeply segmented and divided. It included fabulously wealthy white planters and powerful government officials. It also included poor white migrants who were managing slave gangs or working in the ports, and what were known as free people of color, which is to say men and women of African descent who were not slaves and who often owned slaves and plantations themselves. Many, but not all, of these people were mulattoes. That is, they were mixed white and black. And some were African-born people who had, for whatever reason, become free people and then started to make money for themselves on their own. So free people of color is a complicated issue. And the whole thing of free people itself is not just whites versus blacks. So that's just the first of many complications that occur. There is nothing that you can think about Haiti that is you know, simple and easy, and it is multiple colors, it is mixed, lots of things going on, and you have to just keep an open mind, and although sometimes for ease of discussion, we'll talk about a group of being this or that, but you have to understand it's never this or that. It's three or four things lumped together. The free people of color made up a large portion of the local police and the colonial militia. After all, white guys didn't want to have to go out and troops around doing that sort of stuff. But the job, of course, of the police and the militia was not to protect the island. It was to keep the slaves under control. They were way more, as all slave societies are, the owners were way more concerned about a slave revolt than they were anything else. The Spanish attacking from San Domingo was much less of a concern than the potential for a slave revolt. Now we get to sugar, which is where the money is. Sugar production is ugly. You grow cane. So far, so good. You grow the cane, but when you go to harvest the cane, there are jagged edges on the cane. You get cut. There are snakes and other sort of undesirable critters hiding in the fields. It's hard, backbreaking work to cut this stuff. Once you cut the cane, you have to turn it into sugar almost immediately. There is no storing, unlike tobacco where you hang it up and you season it. This stuff has to go right into the kettles. So they crush it and then they start boiling it to boil it down. The crushing and boiling are really hard work. People, of course, there were no safeguards on these crushers, so people lost fingers, hands, arms, all the time. Often it was women who worked. The men were in the field cutting the cane, and women and children worked in the sugar crushing and boiling process. And so it's they who often ended up missing limbs and other sorts of things. It was not a very pleasant process making sugar. also, of course, the single crop obsession with a single crop growing has the effect of depleting the soil. As the South learned with cotton, as we know, every place you have a single crop and you keep putting it in year after year after year, it has a deleterious effect on the soil after a while. Furthermore, the success of the sugar plantations was leading to deforestation as they cut down bigger and bigger swaths of trees to have lumber to build fancy houses and to feed the fires and to build the thriving port towns that they were shipping the sugar out through. So from an ecological viewpoint, this obsession with growing sugar was not a really great thing. Now, slavery. This system worked only because all this money was being made only because of slavery. As I mentioned, basically, the Europeans, through forced labor, disease, had managed, and warfare, had managed to basically kill off the native population. So they had nowheres to go in terms of having people to do all this nasty work. So they started importing slaves from Africa. And as I said, there's a current that brings them right over. So it was easy to bring them right to Haiti. The slaves were basically worked to death. This is, you know, again, one of the many ugly things about Haitian history is the slavery. It's no uglier than the history of the English, for instance, in Jamaica, although less embarrassing than the fact that in 1787, when the British, 10 guys in England, decided that they were going to bring an end to the slave trade, the largest single slaveholder in Jamaica was the Anglican Church. So when you look at all of the fancy Anglican Church buildings, you, in the back of your mind, you can think, I know whose blood was shed to build those buildings, and it wasn't white people. It was slaves were treated extremely brutally. There was some attempt to control them by rewards, so you could get extra food or some extra privileges if you worked hard and whatever. Because of course, if you're a slave, you have no great incentive to work very hard. The whole trick is to do as little as possible. That's just human nature. So the slaves are trying to do as little as possible, and the slave masters and the field bosses are trying to get them to do as much work as possible. So, and for giving them as little food as possible, because of course that keeps the costs down. most of the control was, of course, by terror. Beatings, and in the case of sadistic owners, they would come up with rather inventive tortures to publicly inflict on slaves to make clear what would happen if you didn't toe the line, if you attempted to run away, you know, etc. So this was a very, very ugly system. And all of the slaves were branded with the initials of the owner. One hesitates to think about the Church of England branding slaves in Jamaica, which is what happened. This branding went on everywhere in the Caribbean. Having survived the whole Middle Passage thing from Africa, you are now dumped into this mess. From which there was no way out. Each year, about 5 to 10% of the slaves died. They died at such a rate that the deaths outpaced the births. So they had to keep importing slaves every year to make up for the fact that they were killing them off so quickly. Some reform-minded people suggested that this economically didn't make a lot of sense, and maybe if we backed off a little bit and tried to let births exceed deaths, that might be a good idea. But these importing slaves was so cheap that they were pushed into a corner, and the slave trade continued. So they kept bringing them over. They'd work them to death. They would die. And there was a guy in Jamaica. I'm sure there were similar guys in Haiti. I just didn't read about them. There was a guy in at least one in Jamaica who, when he decided that the slave had reached the end of his or her useful life period, he would tie a rock around them and throw them off a cliff into the water. Others just contented themselves with working them to death. A more brutal, unchristian way to treat your fellow human beings, one is hard-pressed to come up with. The half million slaves in Saint-Domingue, just prior to the 1791 revolt, about 330,000 had been born and raised in Africa. And more than 40,000 had arrived just 1 year earlier. So there was this constant flow of new African slaves showing up. The newcomers mixed with the slaves who were already there and who were called, and especially those who had been born in Haiti, who were called Creoles. Those people, however, had African parents, and the new Africans had African heritage in common, and they also had, obviously, these horrific conditions that they were living in. And even if you were a first-generation Haitian, you still identified with your African tribe that you had come from. So they identified themselves as Congo Creole, or whatever tribe they came from, Creole. So the African tie was trauma. In order to survive the psychological and physical trauma of the plantation, they would come together, even though they didn't initially speak the same language, and try to figure out ways in which they could build a community among themselves. I mean, people are social animals, and they will do this. So they developed their own rituals of healing, mourning, and worship. Which psychologically obviously helped them. They would also have dances and communal meals off the plantation or at the edges of the plantation as they tried to create a psychological space between the horror of the life they were living and where they wanted to be, so they could get some psychological relief from time to time. The rituals included a whole variety of religious practices, which they brought with them, and they just sort of mushed all of them together, and including Christianity. The royalty in the Congo had converted to Catholicism in the 16th century, and it was widely practiced. Catholicism was widely practiced in the Congo. So they put all of this together and created a religion which they called voodoo. It was a mixture of religions. It was a way in which they could combine religious practices of a large group of people. It was very fluid. Another group came in with other practices. They would combine them and try to put them together. The religion emphasized many groups coming together and forming one common tradition of worship. One of their songs was called "Over the Ocean," which had a metaphor of the Middle Passage as also the way in which we are together here now in this country, in this strange situation, building a community of our own. Voodoo has a lot of interesting metaphors and songs as they try to make sense of where they were. Saint-Domingue also gave birth to a new language called Creole, Oops, I did it wrong. Oh, right. So it's not what we think of as in the Creole that's spoken in Louisiana. Those people would have no way of communicating with these guys. The Creole in Haiti is an entirely different language. It's a mixture of French, various French dialects, and various African languages all sort of mushed together. So they created their own language as also a way to differentiate themselves from what was going on around them. By the middle of the 18th century, that's the 1700s, Creole was spoken by almost everyone in Saint-Domingue, from wealthy masters to the African-born slaves. And it was used in their songs, in their poetries, in the plays that they wrote and performed. It was just the common language. The development of both Creole and Voodoo helped create connections and communities among the slaves. And it's these communities and connections that allow for the conspirators of the 1791 revolt to organize this assault on the masters, the sugar, and the slavery. Which brings us to the 1791 revolt. The 1789 French Revolution sort of gets minds thinking in very different directions all over Europe, and the ideas come across the ocean. I mean, these people are getting French newspapers. They have people coming from France. They're all well aware of what's going on in France. And suddenly, there's a whole new vocabulary about rights and liberty and liberté, égalité, fraternité. There's a whole different way of looking at people and each other. There's a Declaration of Human Rights. There's lots of stuff going on, lots of ideas floating around. Well, the first group that picks up on this over in Haiti are the free people of color. The free people of color are not allowed, they may have money, some of them, but they're not allowed to participate very much in the political process. They object to that, and they say, aha, there's a new order going on in France, we're French. We should be allowed to participate more in the political process. The whites who have control of the process say, well, here's a couple crumbs, shut up. The free people of color decide this isn't enough, and so they push back with a little armed revolt. The first attempt at armed revolt doesn't work out very well, but they make another attempt, and they decide that what they need is more soldiers on their side. So they start arming their slaves. So now the white guys have to arm their slaves. So at first we have a fight in 1790 between the white guys and the free people of color, who have now armed their slaves to fight with each other. Now, in this contest, the free people of color have a bit of an advantage because they're basically the majority of the police and the militia, so they've got arms to hand over to their slaves, and they have military training. So they're in a better position to succeed. There are, of course, two problems with this approach. From the viewpoint of everybody who's not a slave. They have now started to arm the slaves, haven't they? That's one. Two, to the white people, all these characters getting off the slave boats look like cattle. Except that they've just come from West Africa. Many of them are warriors. They've been involved in wars. They know fighting. They know military tactics. They work well as small groups. They're trained fighters. All they need are weapons and a chance. And now they're being given both. So in no time at all, the slaves say, we don't care who wins between the white guys and the free people of color. We have an agenda of our own, namely, we want to be free. So in August of 1791, a group of conspirators in the north of the country, around what is described here as Cap Haitian, which has always been the city of Cap, or Le Cap, until recently when they changed the name, up in the hills from Cap, they put together a conspiracy and a few days later executed it, and rather brilliantly, and they all just rose. And as I said, there's 3,500 of them slaves and 130 white guys. So they wipe out the white guys in no time and start working their way through the plantations, burning them, burning the houses, driving the white guys out. And so the masters get more and more panicked, and they start heading in towards Port-au-Prince and any other place they can think of to go as the plantations are burned or generally taken over by the slaves. So now we have a slave revolt that grows and grows and grows rather quickly. The free people of color decide, well, if there's going to be a contest between the slaves and the white guys, actually, we're probably better off with the slaves. So they join up, and they bring more guns with them and actually have cannons. So they're in good shape. So revolt is off and running. A key leader of the revolt is, I think, the one person in Haitian history we all know about is Toussaint Louverture. He is a key leader of the fight. He has a long, wonderful history, which we don't have time to get into. He's a great tactician, a military tactician. He's a tireless negotiator. And it's his brilliance in military and political strategies that really makes the revolt successful. But Louverture does things like when the revolt breaks out, and he leads his former white masters to safety, and then goes back and joins the revolt, which his biographers, of course, love to talk about. But the white people decide, well, he perhaps wasn't such a bad guy after all. He's not going after them. He's just trying to end slavery. So he has a certain amount of credibility with white people. So he is there are other leaders, and he certainly wasn't the leader of the initial revolt, but that they he is a key player in all of this. And as I say, the person that we all learn about in history is, well, Toussaint Louverture led the revolt. Well, that's sort of true, but there are a lot of other people out there leading and fighting too as they work their way through this process. The French and the English decide that they should help the revolt because there's an opportunity to take over this island where all the money is. So the Spanish, who are over in Santo Domingo, show up and say to Toussaint Louverture, would you be interested in some weapons? We have some weapons. Also, we'd like to come and help you. So Louverture says, okay, great, give me the weapons. So the Spanish come over and help for a while, and when Louverture decides he doesn't need their help anymore, he turns on them and says, get out of here. So he drives them out of the colony back to where they came from, but he keeps the guns, of course. The English decide that they're going to help the white guys. The problem is for white guys is that to take English help means that you're allying yourself with the foremost enemy of France. So you've now, in effect, become a traitor. So the white guys are now beyond the pale, at least those who appear to be conspiring with the English. The two French commissioners who were in charge of the island from the French viewpoint become deeply concerned that this English thing is going to get out of hand. So they decide we need to do something to help spur along the revolt because, I mean, if there's going to be a revolt, we want it to be a French revolt, not an English revolt. So they start handing out, going to leaders and say, okay, well, if you'll sort of stay with us, we'll grant you freedom and some other concessions. And, of course, once you start that, you can't stop it. So they keep giving out to more and more people. And in August of 1793, in order to gain the support of the majority of the population, they abolished slavery completely in the colony, all by themselves. A rather stunning achievement or result. So a delegation from Haiti, including a couple black guys, heads off to France to chat with the assembly, because, of course, the king's dead. And the country's being ruled by the assembly. They go chat with the assembly and talk about égalité, fraternité, and liberté. And they go, yeah, well, that makes sense to us. It turns out there's some abolitionists in the assembly as well. And they'll go, yeah, abolition sounds good to us. So the assembly abolishes slavery throughout the entire French Empire in February of 1794. I mean, the British have vaguely begun to think about it, and the French have abolished it everywhere in France. So the revolt obviously has succeeded. The colony is now free, although it remains a French province. The English, however, decide that this isn't good enough, that there's this wonderful opportunity to seize this wealthy colony, so they invade. And so there's fighting, people getting killed, you know, etc. And the English decide after a while, this isn't working well, so they go home. However, in 1799, Napoleon becomes, in effect, dictator of France, and decides that the Haitians are not paying due respect to his glorious wonderfulness, and also is well aware of the fact that this was a very valuable colony for the French monarchy, and Napoleon always needs money because he's always at war. So he thinks it'd be just swell if we took back the colony and returned it to slavery and went back to making all his money. So he gets his brother-in-law, General Leclerc, and says, go over there. Now they make a big and fix things. So they make a big announcement about how, because Napoleon's a propagandist, oh, we're going over and we're going to help the Haitians and we're going to, you know, bring order and this and that and that. But the Leclerc has, you know, secret instructions for Napoleon to reimpose slavery and to do so as brutally as necessary. So Leclerc and about 10,000 men sail off to Haiti in late 1801. So the Haitians recognize what's happening, and so they burn all the port towns. And a couple of the military leaders burn their own mansion first, and then they burn the town. But they're leaving scorched earth. They recognize they cannot hold the port cities against the French Navy, so they just burn them. And they say, you want to capture this island, you come chase us into the hills. So they went up in the hills. And so now the French are fighting this guerrilla war, and they're getting chewed up along the way. Louverture has said, if we hold them off until the rainy season comes, they'll be in trouble. So it's a matter of dragging this out for a while. It goes back and forth as to whether the French are winning or not winning. Generals change sides multiple times. It becomes very confusing. Louverture at one point decides the French are actually going to win, so he joins with the French army, but they don't trust him, so they send him to France and imprison him, and he dies early in 1803 of you know, illness, cold, being cold, because they lock him up in the middle of nowhere. You know, the fighting goes on, and indeed the rainy season does come. Yellow fever arrives, and what's left of the the French army is now dropping from yellow fever. Napoleon has to keep sending men to reinforce the ones that are dying, and all happens as they die. And finally, in November of 1803, the Haitian army defeats the French, and Haiti declares its independence on January 1 of 1804. So 1804 is the year of independence for them. The next problem they have to deal with is how to run the country. And this is the start of the continuing problem or problems that Haiti has to deal with. They're the first post-colonial colony. I mean, forget the United States. They were an anomaly. This is the first post-colonial colony that is now free. And it's going to be another 150 years or so before there's another one. So they're not only in the cutting edge, they're way, way, way on the cutting edge. So there's no roadmap for these guys. They're like, what are we going to do? Well, it's clear, in the first place, it's clear to them that everybody hates them. They want to have normal relations. They say, well, we're an independent country, blah, blah, blah. And so, hi, wouldn't you guys like to recognize us? And the answer is no one wants to recognize you. The French are mad at them because, after all, they're a colony and they've declared themselves independent, and the French are not about to encourage that sort of thing. The French, the English, and the Americans all have slaves as slave economies and are not about to do anything which will encourage those slaves to revolt. And the fact that the Haitians have had a successful slave revolt scares the dickens out of slave owners everywhere in the Caribbean and in the South. Because if it happens in Haiti, it could happen here. So they're not about to encourage the Haitians in any way, shape, or form. So no one is on their side. So they make what is the seemingly logical conclusion: we need to protect the country. We need to protect the revolution, the revolt. We need to protect our independence. And so they start pouring money into the military. They start building forts, which end up never being used, but they spend a lot of money building forts. The military gets a very significant control of the budget and also generally what's going on, because after all, you never know when the French will show up again, or the English will sail in, or the Spanish will come marching across from Santo Domingo. So, this is quite sensible. Also, of course, all the early leaders, starting with Louverture and the people who become president after him, or leader, all have military backgrounds. Most of them arrive in coups, and so they all have military behind them. And so the military is the important prop that's propping up every government. And so it brings you in. You have to reward those guys, but you don't really want to annoy too much the guys whose leader got pushed out, so you try to get along with them. And the way to do it is keep handing out money. So the military, from the beginning in Haiti, has an oversized involvement in the political process and is way, way, way too involved in everything. And so many of the elite are also part of, the political elite are also part of the military, it's very messy. And so a lot of money gets poured into the military, some of which is lost in corruption, of course, and a lot of which is wasted on getting ready to hold off attacks, which never come. So that's sort of the first problem. The second problem is that the political elite, the wealthy people who tend to be in the urban areas, do not want to share power with the bulk of the population. And of course, their real concern, and this starts now and it keeps going on, and it's true in Haiti, and it's not repeated. Similar statements are made all over the world about Haiti, and that is, the elite says, well, the peasants are too dumb, too ignorant, too uninformed, too unsophisticated. They can't possibly be involved in the government. They should just do what they're told. Luckily, we know what is good for them, so we will tell them what to do, which, as it turns out, makes money for us. But that's just coincidental. We're taking care of them in our own way, but we have to keep them out of the entire political process. This is aided in by, among other things, the fact that the political elite all speak French and the whole rest of the country speaks Creole. It is not until 1987 that Creole becomes an official language of Haiti. It's in the 1987 Constitution. Until then, the vast majority of the population is required to obey laws which it cannot read, even if it was literate, and could not understand if it were read to them because it's all in French. So imagine being in a country in which you're surrounded by a government and laws that have no... You can't even understand what the hell these people are talking about because they're talking in a foreign language. Imagine we're talking Russian. And it's deliberate. It keeps them separated. In its need for money, for the military and for other reasons, successive governments try to figure out, well, what do we do to bring in money? How can we get money here? And, you know, we're all victims of our own experience. And they can't get past... Wouldn't it be swell if we had the plantation system back? I mean, we had lots and lots of money coming in from the exports of sugar. Wouldn't it be really swell if we could redo the sugar plantation thing? Now, the white owners, former plantation owners who are still in Haiti, and the former free people of color who had plantations all think this is a swell idea because, after all, they're going to make money off of it. Now, everybody recognizes you cannot go out to the population and say, good news, we've gotten independence, but we're going to reimpose slavery. That's out. So anything that looks like slavery is going to cause another revolt. I mean, so this is not going to work. So the government works on successive leaders come up with one plan after another to try to have the plantation system. Peasants are told they become serfs in effect. You cannot leave the land in which you live without a pass you can't move, but you can't even go off the plantation without a pass. They quickly develop a system that says, okay, well, you guys work on the plantation and we'll give you a quarter of the earnings from the plantation, so you're not working for free. That's certainly an improvement, so the former slaves grasp this is an improvement, but it's not a big improvement as far as they're concerned. So the government keeps looking for ways to reimpose the plantation system. And in response to this, of course, the peasants are not stupid, all right? The assumption in Port-au-Prince that the peasants are all stupid is nuts. These are in their own areas, they're very sophisticated. They may not speak French. They may not have been in French schools over in France, but they're quite sophisticated. They can smell slavery a mile away. They do not want this to happen, and so they develop what is sort of referred to as the anti-plantation system. And they do it partly by passive-aggressive activities. They don't cooperate much in any of this foolishness. And they start chopping up the plantations as fast as they can, because what do peasants all over the world want? They want their own land. End of story. So they start carving out plots of land for themselves and say, well, this is, you know, in the plantation we always had little plots of land we could grow things on. Well, now we're making our plot bigger. And so, and there aren't necessarily owners around to stop them, and so they start doing their own thing. Well, they do this fast enough that it becomes really hard to undo. There are some attempts occasionally to undo it. It doesn't really work. Some of the leaders over time give up and say, yes, you know, what are you going to do? These guys are out appropriating more land to themselves. What do you want us to do? So they take over enough land in these little plots that it becomes physically impossible, except in occasional places, to reimpose the plantation system. You certainly can't do it countrywide. The other thing that happens is what you can grow, however, is coffee. Coffee can be grown on small plots of land as well as big plots of land. And so Haiti's main export for a long time is coffee, because anybody can grow it. You don't need the obnoxiousness of sugar. I mean, sugar is the third rail of Haitian history. You start talking about sugar plantations, you know, everyone gets their back up and wants to start looking for a gun. But you can talk about coffee and cotton and other tobacco, but sugar is definitely out. So the peasants have created their own way of fighting back to keep this from what they view as their sacrifices, the deaths. In the last year of the fight against the French, 100,000 Haitians died. This was an expensive independence for them. And the peasants are not about to just say, okay, well, the heck with that. They are deeply entrenched in never again. And so anything that smacks of that, they will fight back. And it's made easier for them because power is split out. And so you have local. Now the colors here are the nine provinces of Haiti, and or departments. There were political leaders in each of those areas, military leaders in each of those areas. And so if you didn't really like what was going on back in Port-au-Prince, it was easy enough to get your local guys to start a revolt, especially if they looked like they were reimposing anything that looked like slavery. And you could arm a bunch of people and start a military coup, and in no time you could overthrow the leader and start over again. So there were these constant revolts because you had these diverse, you had military leaders who had ambitions in various places, and the peasants were willing to join up with them. Also, you had lots of ports out of which things were being shipped. Now, the government's answer to some of this was, we need money, and so we need to get it out of the peasants one way or another. And the way they got it out of the peasants was through export and import duties. So they underpaid the peasants for what they had grown, and they overcharged them for what they were buying. So that was an issue for them. We need to stop right here, and next week we'll zip on through 150 years, the last 150 years of Haitian history. So thank you for coming, and we'll see you next week.